I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Congressman Shaka Fatah, who has served 11 terms in the House, was convicted yesterday on all criminal counts, including racketeering, bribery, conspiracy, money laundering, and fraud. The prosecutor said it began when he ran for Philadelphia mayor in 2007 and had to repay an illegal million-dollar campaign loan. The Justice Department said he used federal grants and funds earmarked for charities to pay back the money. U.S. Attorney Zane David Meminger said that Congressman Fatah betrayed the public trust and undermined faith in government. It was a complicated case argued over a four-week period. Now, Fatah did not run for re-election this year and faces pressure to resign. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Dave Davies, senior reporter for WHYY. Dave Davies, always a pleasure. Nice to have you with
Good
us on Radio
you,
Times.
Marty.
Also with us, Aaron Mozell, and he covered this trial for WHYY. And Aaron, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty.
Dave, let me begin with the fact that he was convicted on all criminal charges, just the enormity of the of what the prosecutors were able to prove against Shaka Fatah.
Yeah, you know, we knew 2 years ago about this, the scheme that you outlined at the beginning to repay this illegal campaign loan using charitable and federal funds. But there were other things that got thrown in as well. His accepting many thousands of dollars from his friend, Herb Viderman, a rich guy who wanted an ambassadorship or some other federal post, and for whom Shaka Fatah advocated, there was him trying to get a big federal grant for a non-existent environmental group, which was essentially a way to funnel money along to a political operative, Tom Lindenfeld, that he owed money to. And then there's him using campaign money to pay his son's college debts. A lot in here, and he was convicted of all of it.
Indeed. Aaron, what was Shaka Fatah's defense? You covered this trial for WHYY.
Yeah, so the big picture here is Fatah's lawyers say that he had nothing to do with any of it, that he was completely removed from all of it, and that instead there were these two political operatives that worked his mayoral campaign and kind of stayed with him, that they were the ones sort of pulling the strings on all of this. Some of their proof was that, you know, Fatah's name doesn't appear on any documents, no emails, his signature is nowhere to be found. There's no voice recordings. And so there's really no hard evidence, only verbal conversation to kind of put him in the mix with all this illegal activity.
And Dave, these are the words of Gregory Naylor and Tom Lindenfeld. Were they the ones that,
right,
in a sense, blew the whistle on it?
Yeah, they were the two who pled guilty and cooperated with the government in making this case. It's interesting to me that two other people who were involved in these transactions to repay the loan chose not to make a deal with the government and to take their chances and go to trial. Neither took the stand. I mean, you could see when the government – these facts were laid out in July of 2014, two years ago. And basically had this money being zapped around among various profits and nonprofits that Fatah was associated with that went right to the rich guy who made the campaign loan. And you could see then that if – the money trail was solid, if it was beyond dispute, it would be hard to think of a benign explanation for this $600,000 going bip, 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 and right back to the campaign loan. And I think if there were a benign explanation, we would have heard it, and we would have heard it in court.
Yeah. Aaron, was there some key moments in this trial, sort of either aha moments or jaw-dropping moments? Again, a complicated case.
I think that, you know, most of this case you're talking about prosecutors going through scads of documents and emails and sort of trying to connect all these dots for jurors, and what we've said already is a very complicated case. And so sort of the key moments here are the testimony of Tom Lindenfeld and Gregory Naylor. These are two guys in his Fatah's inner circle. They're only two people really that kind of can put him, you know, with the scheme, with the repayment, with the illegal activity. There were some other colorful moments. You had Ed Rendell come on the stand. You had U.S. Senator Bob Casey come on the stand. So some high-profile people. But in terms of sort of really pinning Fatah to the charges in this indictment, it's these political operatives that sort of provided the most insider look.
Did Shaka Fatah take the stand?
He did not, and neither did any of his co-defendants.
Interestingly, Dave, Senator Casey took the stand. Governor Rendell took the stand. What do you make of what they said? And it sounds like in defense of Congressman Fatah.
Well, Casey was there essentially to indeed confirm the fact that Shaka Fatah had advocated for this rich businessman who wanted an ambassadorship or a big federal appointment.
This is Viderman.
That was Herb Viderman, who was a large contributor to Ed Rendell, who Ed then made a deputy mayor when he was mayor in the 1990s. What was interesting was to hear Ed Rendell scold federal prosecutors for criminalizing friendships. He says these things are, people, friends give each other things. They do one another favors. And I listening to hearing about this, I just kept wondering what he was thinking. Now, if you want to make the case that it's not, it may not have fit the definition of bribery, maybe, but the jury did. But it's just if the notion that you as an elected official can take thousands of dollars from somebody, whether they're your friend or not, and then use the power of your office to advance their career, in this case, to advocate for a big federal job, to give a girlfriend employment, if you think that's okay, you've got a distorted sense of public service.
Are you talking to Governor Rendell?
I'm talking about Governor Rendell, absolutely. I mean, and the fact is, Ed Rendell counted Herb Viderman as a friend himself. Well, he's a friend that Viderman, I don't want to say he bought the friendship, but he gave many tens of thousands of dollars to Ed Rendell's political campaigns. It's hard to kind of maintain your emotional balance about how you feel for somebody if they're helping you at that level.
Mm. Aaron, Viderman did not get the ambassadorship that he was looking for, just to sort of underscore what you're talking about.
Yeah, he did not. So the sort of narrative is that Viderman sort of supplies Fatah with thousands of dollars, including an $18,000 payment to help the Fatahs pay for this home in the Poconos. That sort of was the headline bribe here, and covered up with a sham car sale. They had this Porsche that never actually left their garage. In exchange, Fatah sort of sends letters to Bob Casey and to the Obama administration, and even hands a letter directly to President Obama himself, kind of extolling Viderman and his public service, and that he'd be a great fit for this ambassadorship.
I was going to say what Fatah says in his defense is that if you look at the timing, a lot of those actions on Viderman's behalf were years before the $18,000 payment. So how is that a bribe? And I think what the prosecutors argued was there was an ongoing pattern of Viderman bestowing cash and favors and Fatah advocating on his behalf.
And Viderman was convicted of several counts as well yesterday, right, Aaron?
Correct, including all the charges directed to the bribery scheme.
Dave, is there any connection between what the jury did yesterday and the fact that Shaka Fatah's son was convicted in another case, in fact, is in prison now? Can we connect the dots between these two cases?
I don't think they're directly connected. I think the fact that federal authorities were looking into Shaka Fatah's junior's dealings may have had some impact. Although I think they were looking at probably the congressman even farther back. He certainly says this is an investigation that goes back many years. And I think they connected tangentially in that I believe a tape recording of Shaka Fatah Jr. was used to support the notion that Viderman was giving Fatah Jr. money, which then in fact went to the congressman, actually, ironically, to pay his $2,800 in his city wage tax. That was one of the counts in the indictment. The jury found he was guilty.
What was it like to cover this trial, Aaron?
So, you have this kind of flashy headline where, veteran congressman accused of stealing taxpayer dollars. But then once you get beyond that, this is really a very complex case with a lot of witnesses and a lot of evidence. The government called, I think, roughly 60 witnesses, scads of documents. And so the day-to-day is really actually pretty tedious at times. You have sort of accountants and grant makers and kind of anyone connected to these documents in any way kind of running through line by line for the jurors kind of what this all means and, tons of facts and figures and numbers. And so there were some days with some intrigue, but a lot of it was, sort of sitting there and taking a lot of notes and trying to make sense of all this.
What's been the response from Congressman Fatah in the last 18 hours?
He's been pretty tight-lipped to date. Right after court, he sort of said that this has been a tough day and that he's got to talk with his lawyers about what his next step will be. He put out a statement later kind of thanking his constituents and that he was still, despite all this, pretty proud, very proud of his record.
Dave, what has been his reputation? He served in the state legislature. He's been in Congress, I think, since 1995, if I can do my math correctly here, certainly 11 terms in Congress. How is he viewed in the city?
Well, I think in a number of different ways. I mean, he is one of those political figures who doesn't just hold an office, but built a political organization. He knew how to use the resources at his hand to do favors, to build alliances. And if you look, I mean, he is one of those people who, you know, Aaron and I could sit and name probably four or five elected officials around the city who owe a good part of their political careers to their association with Shaka Fatah. And that made him one of the half dozen or so people who had influence far beyond their offices. So politically, I think he was one of those people who knew how to expand his reach. I think I would also say he seemed to me somewhat entitled. You know, when he ran for mayor in 2007, there were newly imposed campaign finance limits, and he expected to overturn them, not to be bound by them, to be elected with big checks. He thought he would be the candidate of acclamation, that he wouldn't have to go out and earn it. And in fact, when he didn't have the money to wage an effective campaign, that's when he turned to the secret million-dollar loan, which got him into such trouble. It's also interesting to see that he was perfectly willing to tap, you know, federal grants in any number of ways to help associates of his. And so I think that's somebody who just got a little too comfortable and felt, you know, he was kind of entitled to take care of himself. One of the great mysteries about him is why was he in such financial need? I mean,
he had a good salary. His wife made a lot of money,
right?
as a
base salary for a congressman is $174,000. I mean, his wife Renee Chenault Fatah was making many hundreds of thousands. It remains a bit of a puzzle.
Almost out of time here, Aaron. Is there pressure on him to resign his office? I ask that because apparently, having been indicted, he cannot vote.
That's correct. He can just be a congressman in name. Legal experts that I've talked to about this in the past have told me that there will be considerable pressure. Nobody, you know, as much as people like to kind of slam politicians, generally speaking, they like to think of themselves as kind of an ethical bunch, and don't really want to tolerate someone who's just been convicted of kind of being a government official and stealing taxpayer dollars. So there will be considerable pressure. There is nothing, however, in the Constitution that sort of forces him out the door.
Yeah. What do you think about that, Dave?
Well, I think he'll want to hang on to the office as long as he can because of the salary. But, you know, I don't think Democrats in this town are going to be very happy about hosting a national historic Democratic convention with one of their congressmen being a sitting congressman being a convicted felon. Yeah. So I think there will be enormous pressure.
From people like Bob Brady and others, insiders?
All of the above. Civic leaders, political leaders, national, local. But he's his own man, and he's shown that in the past. And he may just decide, I'm going to continue serving my constituents to my last day.
And Aaron, sentencing is set for when?
So there's a couple days. You have October 4th and 5th. Shaka Fatah will be sentenced on October 4th, along with a couple defendants, and then a couple other of his co-defendants will be sentenced the next day.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Aaron Mazel, reporter here at WHYY. Aaron, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Dave Davies, senior reporter for WHYY. And as always, Dave, thanks for coming in and helping us understand Philadelphia politics.
My pleasure.
And do stay with us. We are going across the pond. We'll be talking about the Brexit after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Tomorrow, Britons will vote on whether the UK will remain in or leave the European Union. The Brexit, as it has been called, has become a hot-button issue and revealed some deep divides in the country. Last week, a man killed Joe Cox, a member of Parliament who supported remaining in the EU. He shouted death to traitors, freedom for Britain, at his court hearing. Here's Prime Minister David Cameron, who called for this vote and favors staying in the EU.
Brits don't quit. We get involved. We take a lead. We make a difference. We get things done. If we left, our neighbours would go on meeting and making decisions that profoundly affect us, affect our country, affect our jobs, but we wouldn't be there. They would be making decisions about us, but without us.
There are a number of outspoken critics, including the former mayor of London, Boris Johnson.
We cannot vote for the status quo. The EU morphing relentlessly into a superstate with an increasingly activist court of justice taking more and more decisions about every aspect of our lives including who can be on the streets of this city, whether they are terrorist suspects or convicted criminals or not. And we will be locked into an ever more desperate attempt to bolster the euro by creating an economic government of Europe.
Well, joining us are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. And David Rennie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. We will get him up and running. Richard Deek is with us here in our Philadelphia studio. He's a professor of political science and senior associate dean for faculty and research in the College of Liberal Arts at Temple University, and his research focuses on the German and European political economy. Richard Deek, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
David Rennie, do we have you?
I hope so. Hello.
Hello. This is Marty Moscoen. You're on the air in Philadelphia. Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Let me start with you, Richard Deek, only because we're here in America talking about all this. Should Americans care about the Brexit?
Oh, absolutely, they should care about this. This could have a really big effect on the EU's economy, on its external relations. And if the UK leaves the EU, I think they're going to look more heavily to the United States. As a trading partner, as a partner in global affairs. So it does have a big potential impact on the United States.
David, we'll get into a lot of what's been going on in the UK. Do you think this will impact, or perhaps I can put it another way, should Americans care about the Brexit?
Yeah, they should care in the short and the long term. In the short term, if there is a Brexit vote on Thursday night, you will see a lot of financial turmoil in world markets. Finance is very worried about this. You could see a run on the pound. But in the long term, I think that Americans should see this as really, the country that remains America's closest ally and sort of soulmate in Europe, showing that it is turning in on itself, that it is tempted by the idea of pulling up the drawbridge, becoming an island nation, drifting away from this kind of global, open sort of approach to the world, which has been very useful to America. Britain has been a very useful ally for a lot of American positions in the heart of the European Union.
David, do we know? I've been reading some polls over the last couple of weeks, and it seems that it has been really neck and neck. Is there any way to read how people might be voting tomorrow?
No, it's not only are the polls extremely close, and they've been sort of dancing around kind of 1 or 2 points for a long time. The other problem that pollsters have is that, you know, they normally have a baseline. They can compare this election to the previous election, but we don't have anything to compare this against. We last voted on membership of the European Union back in the early 1970s. And so pollsters are being fairly cautious, particularly as a lot of the result will depend on turnout. We know certainly some very distinctive things about who supports leaving and who supports staying. And it's linked very much to where people live. So people in London, people in rich cities, college towns, better educated people, younger people, non-whites, they're all much more likely to be in favor of staying in the European Union. Hmm. People who want to leave, there's a lot of overlap, people have pointed out, with kind of the core Trump vote here in America. It tends to be older, whiter, less educated, people who feel that they've lost out from globalization and immigration and big changes like that. The problem there, of course, if you're in favor of staying in the European Union, is that the young just don't vote at the same rates as the old. And so that's one of the great unknowns tomorrow.
Interesting. To you, Richard Deek, this is in a sense David Cameron's doing. I mean, he's mm-hmm. the one that said we should vote on this. What was his thinking? This was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that was during a run-up to the 2015 general election in Britain, that he promised that he would try to renegotiate the UK's relationship to the EU, sort of a long-standing, long-festering sort of resentment within the UK, and that he would hold a referendum. And if he did try to renegotiate their relationship and really did not have a lot of success. And so we stand now in front of a referendum where he can't really point to having changed the relationship. And that certainly hurt his campaign to stay in the EU.
Do you think his however people vote, that his future is a bit uncertain?
Oh, absolutely. The Conservative Party has always had a strong Eurosceptic wing, and they're not going to be quieted by a vote to stay in the EU. So his future is always going to be rocky, even with a stay in the EU.
What's that Euroscepticism about, David?
So it goes back a long way. I mean, people need to sort of, if we take the long view, you know, we joined in the early 1970s, we joined late, we joined long after the founding members, and we joined reluctantly. We joined in the early 1970s essentially because the British economy felt like a basket case. Britain was suffering endless strikes, had terrible labor relations. You know, if you remember things like the kind of cars that Britain made in the 1970s.
Oh, yes, we
do.
I think I bought one of those cars, yes.
Yeah, they were a joke. They were terrible things. And, you know, the country felt gray and sad and drab and unhappy. And then they looked across the English Channel. Remember, it's only 23 miles across the Channel. And the European economies looked more dynamic. They looked like they were in better shape. And this free trade pact on Europe looked like a better bet. And so reluctantly and grudgingly, Britain joined that club late. And a club that had been shaped by others according to their interests, things like French farmers and German industry. What's happened is two giant things. One is the European continental economy now looks like a bit of a basket case. So you had a whole bunch of kind of elite conservative businessmen, elite members of parliament at that level who sort of reluctantly backed European membership because it was the price that you paid for access to European markets. Well, now those European markets don't look so successful and dynamic. The dynamic for the last few years has been them saying, well, maybe it's not worth paying that price. All the things that irritate us about Europe come at too high a cost, given that Europe's a basket case. On the level of the general public, mass opinion, Europe has become identified with immigration, with open borders, with loss of control. And that really follows the end of the Soviet Union, and the kind of the final act of the end of the Soviet bloc was the entry of lots of former Soviet bloc countries like Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, all of those Eastern European countries joined the European Union in one big bang. And when they joined, their citizens were given free movement across the EU, and the then government of Tony Blair in the UK open British labour markets, taking a bet that that was the smart thing to do. We at The Economist would still say it was the smart thing to do because we got the best educated Poles and Czechs, because why would they not want to work legally if they have good university degrees? But here's the thing. The British government was stunned by how many turned up. Half a million, more than half a million Eastern Europeans turned up in a country of 60 million people. And from that moment on, immigration in Europe have become identified in the public mind, and particularly with the kind of the white working classes, those people a bit like Trump voters. That's been deadly for the last few years.
Let me pick up on that. I know you want to add something to it. And I have a question for both of you, but I'll put this to you, Richard Deeg. So the UK is in the EU, but does not use the euro, has retained the pound as its currency. Would it be fair to say that Britain was sort of halfway in and halfway out of the EU, even when it joined?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Britain is one of a group of countries that stayed out of the euro. And Britain has also negotiated opt-outs in the past that didn't participate necessarily in everything that the EU did. So it's always sort of been in that situation. And I think, you know, if they do vote to leave, the fact that they're not sharing the euro will reduce somewhat the turmoil that will follow upon that. So in some sense, it's at this point probably a good thing that they're not actually in the euro. But going forward, you know, so they will. There's no reason to think they would ever join the euro. Europe will continue to kind of battle this notion of a two-speed Europe, where you've got an inner core moving together, and the eurozone seems to be moving, you know, to further integration, particularly like in financial markets and regulation. And then some countries like the UK are going to sit on the outside, and that's a kind of a long-term structural problem of the EU that's not going to be resolved if Britain stays in.
I mean, one of the descriptions of the EU is that it's not transparent, it's dysfunctional, I mean, much criticism. On the other hand, Europe has not been at war with itself, or countries have not been at war with each other in Europe, obviously since the Second World War. With some skirmishes and some problems in the intervening years. But to you, Richard, how do you square those two things? Or can we?
From a long-term historical perspective, the European Union has been an immensely successful project, right? It's brought peace and prosperity to all of Europe. But the future going forward is very uncertain. The great financial crisis of 2008, followed by the Eurozone crisis, has created a lot of uncertainty about where the EU goes forward. And then bring into that the whole immigration issue, which has just soared in terms of its effect on and how it's driving European politics, not just in the UK, but across all of the EU.
Well, we are talking about Brexit, the Brexit vote tomorrow, whether the UK will stay in the EU or get out of the EU. And Richard Deeg with us here in our Philadelphia studio. He's a professor of political science, a senior associate dean for faculty and research in the College of Liberal Arts at Temple University. David Rennie with us as well, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. And you can join the conversation. Where do you stand on this particular vote? That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. David, I mentioned in my introduction the fact that Joe Cox was killed by this man who did shout at his hearing, you know, death to traitors, freedom for Britain. Is this, from what we know, in any way tied in with this Brexit vote?
Well, there's been a gigantic kind of row about the extent to which either side is trying to politicize this killing. Remember that in British politics and public life, this kind of violence is very, very unusual. It's the first time that a British Member of Parliament has been killed in office since 1990, and that was an Irish terrorist thing. This is exceptionally unusual. So you've had a lot of conservative newspapers, conservative commentators saying, don't you dare link this to the Europe vote. This man had a long history of mental illness. He seems to have had a long history of contact with neo-Nazi groups and white supremacist groups, including in the United States. This has nothing to do with the Europe vote. People on the other side of the argument have said, okay, we're not blaming Eurosceptics for making this murder happen, but people do bear a responsibility for the tone of kind of nativist, anti-immigrant kind of fear and anger that really has built up to levels that we don't normally see in the UK. And it is the case that some big elements of the Leave campaign, including an anti-immigrant party, UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, which has been a big driver of this referendum, the day of Jo Cox's murder, hours before she was killed, their leader unveiled a poster which many people, including members of the government, described as blatantly racist, which was a photograph of refugees from Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan coming across the field, actually in Croatia, heading for Slovenia. And it just said in blood red letters, breaking point. And that was pretty much a naked appeal to kind of fear of Muslim immigration. And people were very unhappy to see that in British politics.
Well, this is in many ways about identity. I mean, we're having, I think, our own version of this, Richard, in the United States.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one thing that drives right-wing populism across Europe is these threats to identity. First, you know, part of it is within the EU itself, the sense that the EU, the Brussels bureaucrats are legislating things that affect national cultures and preferences. And then, of course, you have this rising immigration. And I think, you know, immigration in Europe is increasingly becoming associated with Muslim immigration. And some people then equate that further to terrorism. Now, that's not necessarily a majority view, but there's enough of a minority that are kind of making these linkages. So the immigration has gone beyond just kind of the numbers of people that have moved into Europe and within Europe, to sort of associating them at least with sort of a more nefarious threat to the EU.
And David, this is something new for England?
Well, it's complicated because there is an element of kind of the Muslim terrorist thing that we've seen everywhere else. But also there is, I mean, you know, if you're going to be blunt about it, the same challenges do not exist when it comes to, say, Polish immigrants who are white, blonde, you know, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, beer-loving, soccer-loving Northern Europeans. I mean, they do not present much of a cultural kind of challenge. But what has happened is you've seen towns, you know, suddenly finding there are Polish shops in the high street, Polish beers in the pub, people talking Polish, talking about crowded schools. I think one of the big problems in the UK is that the government took the decision to open British labour markets, which did draw in this very large number of people. And we at The Economist would say that was still the right thing to do. They were not going to be kept out physically. The borders were open, so you might as well let them work legally. And we got fantastic, hardworking, good people from Eastern Europe. The problem was that in a fit of kind of fatal cowardice, the government of Tony Blair did not talk about it. They opened the borders, they opened the labour markets, and then they were essentially silent. So 500,000 people turned up, and no one from the government was making the case. I think you could make a great case. You could say, isn't it fantastic that these people are choosing to move to Britain, voting with their feet, and choosing to pay their taxes into the British treasury so that Britain can build new hospitals and new schools. And by the way, when you go to our new hospitals, have you noticed how many of the nurses are from Poland or Latvia or from Eastern Europe? It's been a great thing for Britain. But there was this kind of panic in government because they weren't expecting the numbers to be so big. And so they kind of let people's anxiety kind of build without actually explaining to voters what was going on.
Did you want to add to that?
Yeah, just another aspect of immigration in Europe is that during the Cold War, you had relatively limited illegal immigration into Europe, unlike the United States, where you have had a long history of that. But with the opening of the borders, you saw a surge over the last two decades of illegal immigration from North Africa, the Middle East. And that's in addition to migration within the EU, has added a whole new element to the immigration debates within Europe.
Well, and I wonder, too, thinking about France or thinking about Germany, what are their concerns if Britain votes to leave the EU?
Well, France and Germany have always been the two countries at the heart of the EU and have generally worked in tandem to move it forward. And Britain has been sort of the major country, always somewhat at odds with the French and British view, or the French and German view of how the EU should move forward. So if the UK leaves, and ironically, it could in some sense make it easier for the rest of Europe to move forward in terms of, say, building financial and fiscal union post.
They don't need Britain?
Well, I think they need Britain, but in terms of getting agreement, which is always difficult to do in the EU, it might be a little easier without the UK, because the UK has usually been the one that's been pushing against much of the continental Europe when it comes to measures on integration.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about the Brexit vote tomorrow, Britain's impending Brexit vote, and that's Richard Eag from Temple University. Also with us, David Rennie from The Economist. We have much more to talk about after this very short break, including the shape of bananas and regulations. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What do you think about Brexit? Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoing, talking with David Rennie and Richard Deeg. Tomorrow, Britons will vote on whether the United Kingdom will stay or leave the European Union. The Brexit, as it has been called, has been hotly contested as people debate what an exit might mean for the country's economy and for its identity as well. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. David, there have been a lot of complaints about all the regulations that have come from being part of the EU, including things like the shape of bananas. Can you set us straight on that?
So, look, part of this has been a long-running kind of theme in the British newspapers, the British tabloids, who love to talk about balmy Brussels bureaucrats banning things and being too pedantic. I used to work in Brussels as a reporter for 5 years. A lot of it is actually pretty tiresome. I mean, if you write down any regulation, it looks ridiculous when it's written down in kind of legalese. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this stuff is fairly benign. I mean, it makes sense to have common standards for paint and lawnmower noise and all these things so that you can sell products across the whole EU. And one of the things that The Economist, my magazine, finds so frustrating about the promises being thrown around by the Leave camp is they're essentially, we would say, lying to British voters by promising that somehow if we leave the European Union, we can have complete access to sell our goods into Europe, but won't have to obey any of those regulations that the tabloids have kind of mocked over the years. But if you think about that for 2 seconds, it just doesn't make sense. If you are, say, Mars, the big American candy maker, one of their gigantic production centers in the rest of the world is Britain, and they make candy bars in Britain for sale across the whole of Europe. So those factories, they're going to have to obey European rules, but we just won't be at the table making those European rules. You look at a company like Nissan, which has huge car plants in the UK making cars for sale across the whole European Union. If the European Union decides to change some emission standard or some safety standard for airbags or fenders or something, Britain is going to have to either obey those rules with no input, or that Nissan factory eventually is going to think about leaving. And so we would say that this obsession with the idea that European regulations are holding us back is not only kind of promising a lie about what the future could look like, it's also ignoring the fact Germany, which is an incredibly successful export powerhouse, they obey all those same European regulations, and you don't hear the same moaning from them. So it's become a kind of scapegoat for British business, that European regulations are always holding them back. Doesn't mean Europe is perfect. I worked there for 5 years. You know, they did have a big problem with over-regulation in the 1980s and 1990s. There are still people in Brussels whose instinct to every problem is more Europe, even when it's not necessary. But it's an illusion to think that we can somehow throw away the whole of Europe and still prosper.
Go ahead.
One of the things David's actually pointing to here is that one option and a likely outcome if the UK leaves is to remain in something called the European Economic Area, which is sort of where Norway is sitting, which is basically gives you access to the single market, so you have that sort of free access. But then you don't participate in decisions that go along with it. And Norwegian leaders have said recently that what their situation isn't great. In fact, Norway's negotiated twice to join the EU, and both times it was defeated in a referendum. So the UK could find itself in some sense in a worse position. Now, the bigger irony here about sort of all the anti-EU rhetoric is that you go back to the early 1990s, and this whole process of integrating the European economies has actually been built around deregulation compared to what existed before in most European countries. So, you know, the single market, as it's known, which is this effort to sort of turn Europe into a single economy like the United States, is really more built around liberalizing markets and deregulation. So, but the opponents, of course, focus on certain things like the size of bananas or the definition of chocolate. There were famous chocolate wars in Europe. They focus on those kinds of things without kind of recognizing the overall trend of Europe has actually been to deregulate.
We were talking about this during the break. Richard, let's say the Britons vote to leave the EU. What would Scotland do, if I can put it that way?
Yeah, certainly there's this background narrative and discussion going on in the UK that Scotland has long preferred to stay in the EU. And when they had their own referendum, you know, recently to break away from the UK, there a lot of people assumed that they could sort of stay in the EU. And EU leaders sort of signaled neutrality there. They said, well, don't necessarily assume you can stay here. But now that might be different if the UK leaves and Scotland, you know, then votes to leave the UK. They might be welcomed into the EU, partly maybe as a snub to the UK.
And I kind of half stole Mike's question. Let me get him on mic from Kennett Square. David, I'll put this to you. Mike, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hello. Yeah, sure. I think that's very much the question I had. I think all of the discussions I've been listening and watching to, the Leave, and I'm in favor of remaining. The Leave campaign has been very much a case of, well, you know, we'll be able to negotiate our own deals, et cetera. But the UK, I suspect the UK won't look the same if the Brexit happens, because Scotland will want to remain in Europe. So I'm kind of concerned about, well, it's both the dissolution of the UK as a political entity and the economic impact of such a move. And I've not heard much discussion around that.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. David, you want to take that?
Yeah, so the UK is a funny beast because it's made up of one very large country within the UK context, England, which has more than 50 million people, and then the next 10 million is made up of the Scots and the Welsh and the Northern Irish. And so there is a sense that, in part, this desire to leave Europe is a kind of a real flourishing of a sort of English nationalism that we have not seen quite as nakedly before. So remember, we had a vote on whether Scotland should take independence last year. The Scots narrowly voted to stay in the end, or, you know, by a reasonable margin. So there's a question mark now, given that opinion polls show that Scots are more likely to vote to stay in the European Union. Could that trigger an immediate sort of Scottish independence referendum? It's complicated by the fact that at the moment there seems to be limited appetite in Scotland for another independence referendum. No. It's complicated by the fact that the Scottish economy was very much dependent on things like North Sea oil. Falling oil prices have left Scotland feeling a bit vulnerable. But it's not just Scotland that's a mess. Think of Northern Ireland. So on the island of Ireland, you have the British-controlled bit, Northern Ireland in the north, and then you have the Southern Irish Republic, which is going to remain part of the European Union. Yeah. Now, thanks to the end of Irish terrorism and the peace process, the physical border between those two bits of the island of Ireland have basically disappeared, and people now cross across to go shopping and to go to work and things. Would that physical border reemerge? Because if Northern Ireland was not in the European Union and Southern Ireland was in the European Union, that's now an external frontier of the European Union. We have no idea how that works. Would we have to start building border fences and posts again?
You want to add to that, Richard?
Just one comment on Ireland, which, of course, sits in a very interesting situation here. There's a very deep connection between the Irish and British economies, which could certainly be damaged by a UK exit. On the other hand, you know, the Celtic Tiger was built largely on foreign investment, particularly American corporations going in as a gateway to the EU. So if the UK leaves, Ireland becomes, in some sense, perhaps even more attractive as a gateway for many foreign corporations to produce and then export into the rest of the EU.
Let me get Ray from, looks like Yardley, to join our conversation. Hi, Ray. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thank you.
You're welcome.
To follow up on what was just being discussed, and in fact, I think we've been talking about it a little bit, but what really has struck me that we haven't talked a lot about is the degree of disruption that we're likely to experience in the aftermath of this if there is a Brexit. Specifically, I would expect that the EU would now take it out on Britain with respect to the fact that Britain has voted in this way, so that that notion of easy access to European markets, I think there'll be enormous disruption, which we haven't really talked about. And Britain also seems to think that it's going to be able to sell quite a bit into the U.S., and because of the degree of uncertainty that this represents, I wonder if the speakers would talk about whether that's a pipe dream on the part of the U.K. with respect to whether it makes it easier or harder for Britain to sell into U.S. markets.
If they vote to leave, can I put the last one to you, Richard?
Yeah, there's a certain risk here, moral hazard risk for the EU leaders. If a Brexit went smoothly, you know, if they negotiated kind of a successful transition, then that would suggest to other Eurosceptic countries that perhaps, you know, it wouldn't be bad to follow along. So there's a very powerful incentive for the EU leaders to not make this an easy process for the U.K.
To you, David, the idea that if we're putting out a scenario here, but if Britain were to vote to leave the EU, would some of the EU members want to get, quote unquote, revenge on Britain for its vote?
So I don't think it's quite as crude as revenge, although Richard is right that they wouldn't want to show that it was too easy. We've even had comments already from French government ministers to that end. And certainly people like the French have long been cross about, say, the City of London scooping up a lot of business in euro-denominated trade but without joining the euro. They would love to take some of that trade out of the City of London and move it to financial centers in Paris or in Frankfurt in Germany. But I think one of the big kind of lies that the Leave camp have been telling is they have this line that, of course, it's going to be easy. Britain can forge fantastically advantageous deals with Europe because Britain currently buys more from Europe than it sells to Europe. Britain runs a trade deficit with the rest of the European Union. And therefore, Europe would be hurting itself if it didn't give us a sweet deal. But the problem with that is that it's not enough to know the trade deficit, trade surplus, which way the flow kind of works. It's also what's more important. Britain's trade with Europe is a much, much bigger share of Britain's overall economy than Europe's share of its economy dealing with Britain. I mean, you know, I run a trade deficit with Safeways. I buy a lot more from Safeways
right.
than I sell to Safeways. So that doesn't make me the boss of Safeways. You know, you have to know about relative scale too. And I think what people are missing is an important detail. It's not just about vengeance, but European politicians are answerable to their own voters. And those voters are already very unhappy about free trade, very unhappy about globalization. And if they say to them, I'm going to give a deal to these buccaneering, free trade, neoliberal, pro-American Brits offshore who don't want to obey the same environmental or labor regulations as we do, will you let me give them that sweet deal? It's very hard to see voters in places like Southern Europe letting their governments do that.
I mean, it seems, Richard, that even supporters of staying in the EU have a lot of criticisms of the EU itself. Are there calls for some kind of reform or transparency, another way after, 60, 70 years, another way of configuring itself?
Yeah, I mean, in the early 90s, there was a lot of talk about a democratic deficit in the EU, that, you know, the basically sort of a technocratic behind-the-scenes political process going in Brussels making these important decisions. And what you've seen in the last couple of years is very important institution reforms to strengthen the role of the European Parliament, which is directly elected in that decision-making process. So the EU has sort of built up these democratic institutions, but they're not necessarily sort of recognized as having corrected, at least not fully, the democratic deficit. So there is still this sort of widespread sentiment, even among kind of pro-European people, that This is not really sort of a fully formed democratic polity, and it's sort of like an anti-Washington sentiment in the U.S. You see this anti-Brussels kind of sentiment in Europe.
Do you see calls for reform, David?
Well, I have to say I think it's worse than Richard is setting out. So I spent 5 years in Brussels. The solution of the European Parliament was often suggested as fixing the democratic deficit. It doesn't get you there. Most people don't know who their member of the European Parliament is. Turnout is incredibly low in European elections. And the European Parliament is basically a gigantic machine devoted to awarding itself more power and voting for more Europe. And there is a democratic problem. The fundamental democratic problem is that there isn't a European demos, if you like. People do not feel that they belong to a political union called Europe. That has not really worked. Sometimes that's a bad thing. It's about nationalism. But sometimes it just is how it is. You know, people in Sweden view globalization vastly differently to voters in Greece. One of the reasons the euro crisis has been so painful is that Germans and Greeks just view the world extremely differently. They have different social contracts between their electorates and their governments. And Europe's response is often to try and pass rules and new policies and invent new treaties that fix this stuff in a kind of technical way. Hmm. But we've seen the limits of that approach, because if people don't believe it in their hearts, you do eventually run into big problems. So there's a ton wrong with the European Union. And Europe's habitual response is to have more Europe. We at The Economist would say that isn't actually the right approach. But walking away right now is certainly not the right thing for Britain to do.
Yeah. One of the things I think frustrates many Europeans is that you have such diverse views about the EU. I mean, from the beginning, it's been divided between two visions. One, that it should become a federal Europe, much like the United States. Another one is that it should remain sort of an intergovernmental body, more of an international organization. And those have always been clashing. And the result is you always get these very muddied compromises in the EU that kind of move it two steps forward but also one step back. And I completely agree with David here. The other institution, the EU, that sort of undermines sort of the creation of a demos is the European Court of Justice, which has really become a very active court, issuing all kinds of rulings that affect the entire EU. And again, that's not subject to any kind of direct democratic control.
About a minute before we have to end our conversation to you, David, let's say it's a very close vote, 49-51, something like that. No matter what voters in Britain decide tomorrow, does that then leave a divided country against itself because it's such a close vote?
It's been a very angry, ugly campaign. That won't go away. It also leaves an unbelievably divided Conservative Party. Even if he squeaks out a narrow win, the Prime Minister David Cameron has exposed essentially a complete gulf between him and many of his own senior colleagues. Who knows if he can survive this result either way.
Really? But I guess the question is, no matter what the vote is, Richard, how do you sense put the country back together again?
I leave that to my British colleagues to figure out. But I don't see the way going forward. I mean, David Cameron, in some sense, I think David is right. It's very, very much weakened if they leave. But even if they stay in, he's in a very difficult position. There's not a particularly bright future to see for him in this.
Well, it will be fascinating to see what happens tomorrow. David Rennie, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. Richard Deeg, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
And again, Professor of Political Science at Temple University. His research focuses on the German and European political economy. Wrote a book called Finance Capitalism Unveiled. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moskowain. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. But don't go away. Got hour two coming up. We'll be right back.